From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, talking with vaccine-hesitant parents as measles cases spread.
If what you want to be effective at is changing minds, shaming, stigmatizing, criminalizing people doesn't change minds. Rather, relationship building, communication, patience, and trust. These things change minds.
Is there a connection between ALS, pesticides, and industrial chemicals?
We're seeing that these chemicals seem to influence one's risk or likelihood of getting ALS.
Competitive beard growing in West Michigan.
People stigmatize big beards, but I've discovered that big beards go hand in hand with big hearts.
Plus, how your old photos can help researchers track changes to Lake Michigan's dunes. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The number of measles cases in Michigan continues climbing, with 41 cases confirmed. That's led to doctors and public health officials grappling with just how best to deal with a public health crisis that is spreading across the country. A middle school in Birmingham ordered unvaccinated kids to stay home after a student was confirmed to have measles. In Brooklyn, New York, people who refuse to get themselves or their children vaccinated could face fines. Rockland County, New York, issued an emergency order banning unvaccinated children from public spaces. So are these effective methods to protect public health and change the minds of parents who choose to not vaccinate their children? Here to talk about that is Mark Navin. He's an associate professor at Oakland University, where he teaches bioethics and he researches vaccine refusal. Mark, we know that even though a large majority of Americans do have their children vaccinated, CDC numbers show the number of unvaccinated kids is rising. Why?
Well, I think one of the first things to think about is how many different reasons these parents have and how many different communities that they're coming from. So one mistake I think we can make when thinking about vaccine refusal is relying on our sort of gut stereotypes, right? And I think there is a sort of popular stereotype of a certain kind of overeducated white suburban mother who trusts her own intuitions and nature and is skeptical about mainstream medicine and the government. And while that might sometimes be accurate, one way to challenge that is to think about some of the recent outbreaks, right? So Manhattan and Oakland County, these are communities of Orthodox Jews. Minnesota a few years ago had an outbreak in a community of immigrant Somali Muslims. Pennsylvania's had outbreaks among the Amish. And so I think one way to start thinking about vaccine refusal and understanding where it comes from is understanding it comes from a lot of different places, a lot of different values, a lot of different kinds of beliefs. And so, for example, we know in Oakland County, many of these folks are not committed vaccine refusers. The problem is largely a sort of lack of good integration with public health.
When and where and why, Mark, did vaccine opposition really take root in the United States?
Well, I mean, this is a sort of question about history, and in history, line drawing gets hard. We know that there's been vaccine refusal from the beginning of the history of vaccination. So in England, it starts very soon after you get vaccines, and it gets organized once the first vaccine mandates start in mid-19th century, and with a similar mobilization in the United States, with multiple organizations of citizens, often calling themselves things like the Anti-Vaccination League.
So this is not new, but certainly there seems to be a greater awareness, and we're seeing an acceleration in the number of parents who choose to not have their children vaccinated. What does that stem from?
Well, so, I mean, it's worth sort of saying outright that the overall rates of vaccination are at or near historical highs. And so we're actually in a period of great success in public health efforts. And so it's important not to panic and be proportional. It's frightening, right, that we had a disease, measles, that was eradicated in the United States. It's back. But in some ways, where we are now is more the norm than the kind of decades we had where we were maybe excessively optimistic about getting rid of it. As for why its sort of concerns come back, I would say a lot of the concerns are the concerns people have always had. You know, on the one hand, this is an intervention you do on healthy children that it's hard for some people to wrap their heads around. On the other hand, when you don't see the disease, it's hard to be motivated about prevention. And then I think on other hands, there are deep sort of political divides in this country. While people in public health and in medicine are really committed to sort of solidarity and public projects, I think just looking at the state of politics in Michigan, if not our country, shows that we really disagree with each other about what kind of resources and efforts we should be expected to deploy towards things like fixing the roads, right? Mm-hmm. And we also disagree about the rights of children. You know, we're having debates about gun ownership, right, and guns in the home, and or even things like swimming pools and driving SUVs, and about how these put both our own kids and other people's kids at risk, we have a sort of ongoing and evolving debate about where we draw these lines in our decisions about how to live together.
I'm speaking with Mark Navin, who's an associate professor of philosophy at Oakland University, where he teaches bioethics and social and political philosophy. I want to talk about the response on the part of public health officials to this growing outbreak of measles. We mentioned a few of them at the top, with fines and banning unvaccinated children from schools and public places. Are these effective in your view?
So maybe I should just start by saying I'm very pro-vaccine, but I tend to be, in my written work, critical of a lot of the ways in which we sort of respond to or think about responding to vaccine refusal. And one criticism I have is we sometimes rely on an oversimplistic way of thinking about these responses. And so you asked, are they effective? And I think there are at least four different questions worth keeping separate, because there may be different answers to each of them. And so we might ask, are they legal? Right? Mm-hmm. Are they ethical or just? Are they legitimate? And are they sort of wise or prudent?
And I think the bottom line is, do they result in more children getting vaccinated?
Well, yeah. So this is a question about wisdom or prudence. And the easy answer is yes. In the short term, they certainly do. We know this in California. You know, non-medical exemptions, once you take them away, more people are going to get vaccinated because they don't want their kids kicked out of school. We don't know what the long term is going to be. But even if in the long term it helps with keeping kids vaccinated, there might be other social costs that make it unwise to ramp up coercion, even when it's effective at decreasing refusal and increasing immunization. So, you know, we want our kids to stay in school. We want parents to be able to stay in the workforce, which means having daycare. We want people to trust public health and their government. We don't want immunization policy or public health policy more generally to become any more polarized than it needs to be. These are all other good things that we want to do. And so we have to balance these sorts of good things we want against also wanting to increase immunization rates as high as we can get them.
So what would be a more effective approach from the public health establishment?
Well, I mean, I think one question to say is we know some things don't work. So I mean, effective hides a lot of different things. So if what you want to be effective at is changing minds, shaming, stigmatizing, criminalizing people doesn't change minds. Rather, relationship building, communication, patience, and trust, these things change minds. And in particular, when these relationships occur across sort of existing affinities, right? So the people who are able to change my mind are people with whom I agree with about most everything else, which really tells in favor of public health being well integrated into the various communities they serve. But if you mean changing behavior, well, yeah, coercion works, but it has lots of costs. And so, as I said before, I would want to balance the effectiveness of getting behaviors to change against some of the other costs you end up paying when you ramp up the coercion.
You talk about someone you have a relationship with that you respect, which leads me to ask you about parents and the pediatrician. So let's say I'm a pediatrician. I have a parent who comes in with the child and refuses the recommended schedule of vaccines. So what should I do or say, and what should I not do or say?
This is a hard question. So and maybe thinking first about the American Academy of Pediatrics and their evolution on this issue is helpful. In 2005 and then reaffirmed in 2012, the American Academy of Pediatrics said that pediatricians should not dismiss these families from practice, but should keep them and should continue the relationship and continue educating and counseling and building trust on the hope that some parents would change their minds. In 2016, they said dismissing these families was an acceptable option, given the sort of burden on clinicians and some worries about risks to other patients. So I'm sympathetic with the sort of struggles among pediatricians facing these problems. I think it's best for kids, and I think it's best for the community, and frankly, I think it's best to fairness among pediatricians for them to keep vaccine-refusing families in their practices. One worry, right, of course, is if these people are dismissed, they end up clustering in the few practices that take them and increasing the risk of outbreaks. In fact, we've had one measles outbreak in California that originated in the waiting room of an office of a pediatrician who accepted vaccine-refusing patients.
I think you and I know, as we talk, there are parents hearing this who want to scream to the vaccine-hesitant parents, you choosing to not vaccinate your child puts my baby, my child, at risk. We get feelings like that, and they could lead to vitriol and anger and everyone shutting down. How do we change that into constructive vaccine communication?
I mean, one way that I try and manage, because I share those emotions, and that's where I begin. It's how I started this, having young kids and realizing some of my acquaintances weren't vaccinating. I didn't change my mind about the importance of vaccination, but I was able to sort of tamper some of the anger by thinking that you know, we disagree with each other about a lot of ways in which it's reasonable or not to place other people's kids at risk. Someone who puts a pool in my neighborhood, even if they put a fence around it, just put my kids at risk. Someone who drives an SUV, right, puts my kids at risk since we drive a smaller car. Heck, the city planners in my city who don't have physical barriers between the bike lanes and the roads have put my kids at risk when they ride in the bike lanes. And so I think thinking this is a political question about how we balance various interests in society together, a question of which I think vaccine refusers are on the wrong side, but nonetheless an ongoing debate and discussion among reasonable people, I think that helps me think about and sort of manage my emotions about this better.
And to the parents who say, it is my right to not have my child vaccinated, where do we meet?
Well, it depends on what they're claiming, right? So if they're claiming that in Michigan right now you have a legal right to refuse, well, certainly you do. And even in Brooklyn, some people have called this compulsory vaccination, but still you have a right to refuse. You just have to pay a fee, right? So the degree to which it's criminalized is still kind of moderate, right? There's a way to buy your way out of it. But I think it's a difference between what the legal rights are and what we think they ought to be and what we think moral rights are. And so I think, no, you're sometimes people talk about their children as if they're their property, or talk about their rights over their children as if you can do whatever you want to your kids so long as you don't kill them. I think that's wrong, but members of this society disagree with me. And so in some ways, this is a debate about democracy. In a democracy, we don't always get what's just, right? We don't always get the best answer. But we try to get what's legitimate, which is to say what sort of represents the will of the people. But sometimes my fellow citizens disagree with me, and so the will of the people that's expressed is not, it's going to be suboptimal from a sort of point of view of rights or what's good.
Mark, is there the, I'm going to use air quotes here, is there a solution to this dispute, to this debate?
I mean, I suppose it depends on what you say the problem is. If you're narrowly scoping this to immunization rates are low, then sure, ramp up the coercion, bring the state power down, you'll get those rates up. But if the problem is lack of trust in government, or lack of social solidarity, lack of willingness to do your part to keep up our institutions. I mean, I really think there's a deep analogy with our roads, right? A lot of the previous generations in the state built up great infrastructure. It falls to us to keep it going. A lot of us seem unwilling to keep it going. We inherited herd immunity, community protection with high immunization rates. It falls to us to keep it up. But I think we sort of lack a sense of social solidarity. So if, depending on how you scope the problem, whether or not there's a solution that's easy at hand is either going to be well, obviously true or difficult to find.
You've really given us a lot to think about. This has been really interesting talking to you, Mark Navin, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Oakland University, where he's done extensive research on vaccine refusal and the public health response to it. Mark, we want to thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thanks, Cynthia. It's a great conversation.
Stay with us. We'll be right back after a quick break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, which means it's time to talk history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
With two peninsulas, 83 counties, Michigan is a large state. For instance, a completely in-state drive from Monroe up to Ironwood would take you over 10 hours. To get a better sense of Michigan's varying geographic and historical differences, we thought it would be fun to break down our state county by county. Last week, we introduced our History Center spinning wheel with Michigan's 83 counties on it, and it spun and came up with Isabella County. So we're going to get the lowdown on Isabella County as we welcome back State Archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. And Mark, before we start talking about history, I'm going to bet there are some folks listening to us, because we're all over the state, who may not exactly know its location. So where is Isabella County and what are some of its geographic features?
Isabella County is almost dead center in the middle of the state. So this is almost dead center in the palm of your hand, pretty much central. An area that's marked by glacial features, including something called moraines, which is where the glacier just pushed rock and soil together and created some mild rises. And the soil is, in the research we did, is sort of hit or miss. It was either clay or really sandy washed out soils. Agriculture is really big and lumbering, as it was in many parts of Michigan, was a big industry and part of the geography early on.
All right, so almost smack in the center of the Lower Peninsula. And of course, the area was inhabited long before European colonialism by indigenous people, probably Anishinaabe. Tell us about the role of Native American people today in Isabella County.
The Saginaw Chippewa tribe is a robust part of the community, but it's also its own separate government, including courts, police force, governing council, and other various government departments and commissions. So it's its own sovereign entity. They even host the Michigan Family Olympics in Mount Pleasant, and they have a robust educational and cultural program for their community.
You know, in fact, I know we have certainly explored that here on Stateside with members of that nation. So when did Isabella County kind of start to form into the government structure, you know, within the confines of the state of Michigan that we know today?
The boundaries of Isabella County were first set off in name in 1831, so actually when Michigan was still a territory. And if you've seen any of those early maps of Michigan, they don't really look much like Michigan, but Isabella County was set off in name, but it was actually part of Mackinac County for a long time, as was most of the middle to the north of Michigan. It really got enough population to become a political structure in law in 1855 when they created co-township, and then Public Act 118 of 1859 set aside Isabella County as an official county. But this was organized after nearly 60 years of broken treaties removing the indigenous people from their land.
And again, certainly something that we have seen repeated around not just Michigan, but yes, throughout this country. Tell us, Mark, how did Isabella County evolve as it went through the 20th century into today?
Well, originally the county seat was Isabella Center, but a year after the county was created, voters approved the transfer of the county seat to Mount Pleasant. Interestingly, a gentleman named David Ward donated a large amount of land in that area, which I think helped that move happen. And I think listeners will want to remember that name, David Ward, because as we do these county histories, that name's going to keep coming up because he bought a lot of land on speculation. There's even a town in northern Michigan named after him called DeWard. But the county grew slowly, so population in 1860 was around 1,400 people. Currently, we're in the low 70s for population, low 70,000. So incremental growth, it's due to the fact that this is a largely initially cut over timber. You know, lots of logging industries. There's still a lumber mill present in the county, but largely agricultural production to this day.
And certainly known for Central Michigan University in Mount Pleasant. What else would Isabella County be able to lay claim to?
I think it's probably best known now for the Saginaw Chippewa tribe that's there. They've remained a vital part of the community and run the Soaring Eagle Casino there and have the Zeboing Cultural Center, which is just a gem that everyone should go and see. And of course, Central Michigan University. I think one of the gems in Central Michigan that's missed is the Clark Historical Library. And we've spoken with them here on this show. They have one of the largest collections of Ernest Hemingway papers, other than the JFK Library, at the Clark Historical Library.
Well, who knew? Now, finally, how did Isabella County get its name? Do we know?
There's a couple different stories. Neither of them are good. So one is that a gentleman named Henry Rowe Schoolcraft provided the name or suggested the name after Queen Isabella of Castile. And the other is a very cliche attribution that many county histories have for their county, that the county was named after the first Caucasian female baby born there. So neither of them are really compelling, but the explanation that Schoolcraft named it after Queen Isabella of Castile is probably the most compelling at this point.
The ins and outs of Isabella County. Thanks again to State Archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey, as we kick off our county history features. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And as we explore county histories, we figured it would be fun to speak with a local history buff. We called up the former president and longtime member of the Isabella County Historical Society, Sherry Sponseller. And we asked Sherry, what's the strangest story from your county's history?
We had a triple murder here just after the turn of the century. In Isabella County, we've only had two triple murders forever, and it was a domestic dispute. The marriage occurred in 1900, and the young woman involved was only 16. And she was a country girl, a young, innocent kind of gal, didn't realize her husband had quite such a temper as he did. They had a child within the first year, and then the spousal abuse kind of got started, and she made the decision to move home with her parents and the little child and gave him basically visitation rights. He took the child to his parents' home many times to take care of her, and the wife went into Mount Pleasant, the county seat, and actually filed for divorce. And when he was served the papers, his temper got the best of him, and he went to the hardware store and bought a gun. Well, he went to his in-laws' home thinking his wife was there. She wasn't, but in his rage of temper, he killed her mother and her father. And then he went to his own parents' home and killed his own child. It was written up in the paper, you know, as an extraordinary thing. And they wrote about the funeral, how many hundreds of people showed up with horses and buggies. And then that whole entourage came into the town of Mount Pleasant from the country church to where the parents and child were buried together in our local city cemetery. It occurred in 1902. So, I mean, we got a lot of things. Spousal abuse wasn't discussed. Divorces were extremely uncommon for anybody to have. So in 1902, that in and of itself was quite different. And then to have him murder her parents and the child even, that was probably the worst part of it. It was called the Gulick Murders, G-U-L-I-C-K.
And that was Sherry Sponsaler of the Isabella County Historical Society. If competitions are your thing, you know you can compete in just about any field, and that includes beard growing. Just ask the members of the Old Dog Whisker Club of Kalamazoo. Its co-founder and club president, Andy Miller, is here now. Andy, why did you create the Old Dog Whisker Club?
Well, my wife and I discovered competitive bearding just by watching Netflix. A couple years ago, we watched Whisker Wars, and that kind of got me intrigued by it, and then I followed it a little bit. And when I saw, though, that the World Beard and Mustache Championships were being held in Austin, Texas back in 2017, I decided to go. So my first beard competition was actually the world's. Most people would recommend that's not the way to start competitive bearding. But my wife and I had so much fun down in Austin. We met so many people. And, you know, all of this stuff is ultimately for fundraising for good causes. And we were just really amazed at the people we found. I often say that, you know, people stigmatize big beards, but I've discovered that big beards go hand in hand with big hearts.
Oh, there you go. Well, I have to ask about your beard. First of all, how long since you have had a smooth, no whiskers chin?
Well, I can tell you the last day that I shaved, I remember it was December 19th, 2016. And it also happened to be the day that the Electoral College confirmed President Trump. That's how I remember the date.
All right. So you've got that down. And do I understand you didn't kind of go full Monty initially, right? You kind of grew your beard in stages?
Well, I've had a mustache for a long time. My father was known for his big handlebar mustache. So I was originally going to compete in just in mustache category. But when I saw, frankly, what the competition was, I decided that maybe I would grow out the beard just to see what happens. This is the longest I've ever grown my beard, so it's a little over 2 years old. But I'm a consultant in real life, and so I was concerned a little bit about getting too non-professional looking. So my first category that I competed in was partial beard. But since then, I've let it grow out, and I've been competing in the natural beard category. And right now, I'm in the 4-inch to 8-inch. I'm right in between right now. I'm right at about 6, 6.5 inches.
Oh, boy. And how have you done competing?
I've really done pretty well. I have the club has really done well. For a club that's relatively new and relatively small and growing, for example, in Fort Wayne, we came home with 2 first place and 1 second place finish. And before that, in Louisville, we brought home 2 third-place finishes and 1 first-place finish in a styled mustache. This little club in Kalamazoo, we're starting to get recognized.
And I can tell from what you're saying, there are a lot of categories to these beard competitions.
Oh, well, it depends from one competition to the next. Like the National and the Worlds have a total of 33 different competitive categories between mustache, partial beard, full beard, and then you have the crazy guys who do freestyle. I don't know if you've ever seen any of the pictures of that, but some of these guys spend 8 hours or longer dressing their beards up with hairspray and gels and turning them into wild and crazy shapes. And so that's a lot of fun. That brings the crowds out. The crowds really like the freestylers.
I can only imagine. I have to wonder, here you are with your beard. You're kind of in the middle of that 4-inch to 8-inch. That's a lot of beard. How much time does optimal beard maintenance take for you every day?
Well, as far as every day, it takes almost zero time, to be honest. Now, when it's competition time, I'll spend probably a half hour to an hour between shampooing, conditioning. In the natural beard category, you're not allowed to use any kind of waxes or hairsprays, but you are allowed to condition it and use like leave-in conditioner. So I'd say a half hour to an hour when I'm competing. But other than that, frankly, I roll out of bed and I comb it out. And sometimes it looks good. Sometimes it doesn't look so good until the next shampoo.
What food is the most challenging to eat with a full glorious beard?
Oh, like spaghetti or soup gets a little hairy. I have a fairly strong mustache, but I keep it combed out of my mouth for the most part. But if you see some of the guys with the big, full, natural beard and mustaches, they have to kind of use their hand to cup their mustache to get their mustache out of the way when they put food in their mouths. I think that's taking it to a little bit of an extreme.
There you go. And this is from the guy who co-founded the Old Dog Whisker Club. Tell us why that name.
Well, one of the things when I talked to the Austin Club president, Brian Nelson, who's also the president of the National Competitive Beard and Mustache Alliance, he told me that one of the keys to the early success of the Austin Club was that they met at a regular time and at the same place for a good solid year or 2 years. And so my good friend Sean Smith is the owner of Old Dog, and I just wanted to bring him some business. And so I decided that Old Dog Tavern, plus it's just comfortable, we like the Old Dog. And then we even carried that theme further with a nonprofit charity that we've selected, the Gray Muzzle Organization. It's a national organization. Their motto is that no old dog should die alone or afraid. I almost get choked up every time I say that. But basically, the money is raised through a combination of competitor fees and entrance tickets, raffles, and then I'm also seeking out sponsors to take care of some of the major costs. I guess I won't plug it yet because this is nonprofit radio, but we've been very lucky. And actually, this beard club led me to a point where I'm actually now the paid actor and talent for a national beard product company. I won't say who it is, but you can find out soon enough. And I'm going to be the face and voice of a national beard product company.
What a whole world this is open. And one final thing, do I understand that the Old Dog Whisker Club welcomes women?
Absolutely. We welcome everybody. We have twice as many couples members as we do single members. We're also very LGBTQ friendly. Everybody's welcome. We're very inclusive. Part of our club goal also is to kind of destigmatize facial beards. You know, we want to make people realize we're all just normal people. We're not a bunch of bikers or backwoods, you know, crazy dudes. We're just normal people who happen to be able to sport some pretty awesome facial hair growth.
Keeping competitive bearding going in Kalamazoo, Andy Miller, Old Dog Whisker Club of Kalamazoo. Andy, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
The 2018 Poet Laureate winner for the Upper Peninsula was so popular, he won a second consecutive term. He was voted in last month. Interlochen Public Radio's Taylor Wisner spoke with him.
To say Marty Acats was surprised to be nominated as the UP Poet Laureate for a second time would be an understatement.
I was absolutely flabbergasted. It's still stunned for a couple days.
Regardless of what he says, the Ishpeming native is a fan favorite for a reason. Reading his poems, you feel the pangs of heartache and moments of joy in equal measure. Marty says his poems are simple. The language is easy to comprehend on first listen, so he thinks people who don't read poetry much tend to get something out of it. Here he reads Waiting for Independence Day Fireworks 2013 from the anthology Undocumented Great Lakes Poets Laureate on Social Justice.
Two men appear. One carries a blanket. Their hands almost touch as they walk together. They spread their blanket on the ground, the way my mom and dad used to spread towels on the beach in August, without need for word or direction, an easy ballet of arm and hand.
Marty says living in the Upper Peninsula is ripe for writing poetry. He says the hardships of living in the UP and making it through 6 months of winter can be tough on his spirits. But he says he wouldn't live anywhere else.
I don't know of a place, any place else in the United States where I can step out my front door in the morning and I can see an albino whitetail walking down the street. There's a poem just walking down the street in front of me. And that's what really, you know, draws me and keeps me here in the UP is that really hard beauty that exists and that sort of fuels what I do.
Marty is currently working on two collections of poems. One is about the North American folklore figure, Bigfoot. Here he reads from his poem, Bigfoot Tries to Fix His Daughter's Broken Heart.
Since he doesn't know the word love, he paints her face with clay, tenderly, with his tongue. Since she won't eat, he collects fistfuls of spring peepers, scoops them between her lips. They sing in her mouth.
Marty says the poem is about those kinds of deeper struggles that every person goes through.
That's what poetry really is all about. It's about, giving words to situations and emotions that are really difficult to express.
Marty will travel all around the UP to spread his poetry and highlight the poets of the region who many may not know. Marty Acats will be reading his poems at the Escanaba Public Library in late April. For Points North, I'm Taylor Wisner.
Lots more to come after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It can start with trouble walking, maybe some tripping and falling, maybe muscle cramps, unexplained weakness in your hand, or trouble swallowing. And those early signs could result in a diagnosis of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS. Some call it Lou Gehrig's disease after the famed Yankee slugger. ALS forced him to retire in 1939 when he was just 36, and he died 2 years later. A recent study by researchers at the University of Michigan explores connections between the progression of ALS and organic toxins like pesticides, industrial chemicals, the kinds of toxins that are long-lasting and common in Michigan. Here now is the primary author of this study. He is the director of U of M's ALS clinic. Dr. Stephen Gutman, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me here and talking about this great work that we're doing.
Well, before we talk about the study and your research, explain to us exactly what happens with ALS.
Sure, absolutely. So ALS is a disease of what we call motor neuron cells. And these are cells that are both in our brain and in our spinal cords. And so these brain cells send these wires down to motor neuron cells in our spinal cord that eventually connect to our muscles. They tell us how to move and how to chew, how to swallow, how to breathe. And for reasons that are quite complex and we don't entirely understand at this point, these nerve cells die. And this leads to these progressive symptoms that you had mentioned, trouble with arm and hand function, trouble with leg and foot function, difficulties with breathing and speaking and swallowing. And so it is unfortunately a disease that is progressive and we don't have a cure for it. We're working hard, but right now we don't have that magic medication that's going to stop or reverse disease.
What's a typical lifespan after diagnosis?
So ALS is a frustrating disease because it's not recognized early. And so most people, from the time they start getting symptoms to the time they're diagnosed, it takes about a year. And that's because you have this very strange onset of symptoms that you just kind of think maybe due to aging or to other things. And so people start thinking, oh, I have carpal tunnel syndrome or I just have a pinched nerve. And it's only after time, as the symptoms progress, that they start saying, something's going on here. The average survival, or what we say the median survival time from the onset of symptoms, is in this range of 2 to 4 years. And so it is a short period of time. We as physicians who treat ALS have to do everything in our power to really make sure that we're allowing people living with ALS to have a full life and to enjoy life that's in front of them.
I know there are about 5 to 10% of cases that are inherited and about 90 to 95% that are sporadic, which means you really don't know why someone gets this.
Right. And so you are correct. There's about 10% of individuals with ALS have a familial form of disease, meaning that this disease is run in their family are that there's a identifiable gene mutation that leads to disease. The other 90% have what we call sporadic. Now, sporadic doesn't mean not genetic. And I think this is an important concept and really particularly relates to what we're talking about today because it's what we call a polygenic disease. And so basically what this means is that we all have some susceptibility, underlying genetic susceptibility to any form of disease, whether it be high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, lung cancer. And so it's your genes that kind of push you up a cliff to trigger you for a disease.
Okay.
But then it's your contacts with the environment or your environmental exposures that then push you over the cliff. So what I tell my patients is that it's almost like cigarette smoking and cancer, right? So there are individuals that we know who've smoked forever and they never get cancer. And you're like, how is that possible, right? But there are some who they smoke maybe even for a short period of time and they get lung cancer.
Or never smoke.
Right.
Yeah.
So they had that susceptibility and it was those environmental triggers that pushed them over the cliff to get the cancer. And so it's the same in ALS. And so this is – when we say that 90% of people have the sporadic form of ALS, what we mean by that is that we're trying to identify all these different triggers that prime them to eventually get ALS.
As you say, tip you over the cliff.
Exactly.
So that's what you were trying to answer, those kinds of questions with this study?
Exactly.
And what'd you learn?
So I'll take a step back before we start off and say that we've been doing this research for about 10 years. So under the direction of Dr. Eva Feldman, she really started what we call the biorepository of our patients. And so what we did was we began to collect exposure histories from our patients who are coming in to see us. And in addition, also collecting samples of biofluids, so blood and urine samples, that allowed us to help begin to understand what are the exposures that one may have had that maybe primed them to getting disease, and also had the ability to measure exposures, whether it be through blood or through urine. And one of the things that we reported on a couple years ago was the levels of what we call these persistent organic pollutants in blood from people with ALS compared to those with healthy controls. We were interested in these POPs, as we call them, these persistent organic pollutants, because these are chemicals that have been manufactured for various purposes. The three categories that we focused on are pesticides, so what we call the organochlorine pesticides. They're, for the most part, no longer in use around the world with a few exceptions. What we call polycoordinated biphenyls or PCBs. These had functions in industrial applications. They were used in electrical equipment and additives and paint
and they wound
and plastics.
Up in cattle feed and got into the food chain in Michigan.
So, right. So I won't talk about the PBB story, but absolutely. And then the third class are the brominated flame retardants or the PBDEs. And these were materials that some are currently in use and some have been banned in the United States in the early 2000s to help reduce the flame properties of materials or make them less combustible.
Okay. So when you examined the patients all these samples, these folks, these patients tended to have a higher amount of these chemicals?
Yep. So in our publication a couple of years ago, which we published in JAMA Neurology, what we saw is in our individuals that have ALS compares to those that do not, they had higher amounts of the PCBs and the PBDs as well, but particularly the pesticides. And so one of the questions we had was, okay, we're seeing that these chemicals seem to influence one's risk or likelihood of getting ALS. But does the story stop there, right? So does it matter that you have these chemicals in you and then once you have them, is the story over? Or can these chemicals lead to some ongoing effect on disease? So what we did was we looked at all of these pollutants together and we said, we think that it's not just one of these pollutants that matters, but a combination of them that influence disease or have some impact on the way disease progresses. And we divided our group up into quartiles and we compared the group that had the lowest levels of pollutants compared to the group that had the highest levels of these pollutants in blood. And essentially those individuals that had the highest amounts or concentrations of all of these pollutants in their blood had a mortality rate of twice that of the lowest group. So they were dying at twice the rate of the group that had the lowest level. And that worked out to about 6 months or so. It wasn't statistically significant that 6 months, because we had to adjust for some ALS progression factors.
But it tells you something, that the presence of these toxins can affect the progression of the disease.
Absolutely. And so that is one of the things that we need to further understand. So we're showing an association here, and we're saying that these toxins have some association with the progression of disease. And now we have to dig deeper to understand what are they doing at a mechanism level to these brain cells, to these nerve cells, to make disease progress.
Now, you're studying patients, clearly, coming to your clinic. So we're talking about people in Michigan. We know Michigan has one of the highest rates of ALS in the country, according to the CDC. And then you stop and you think Michigan has 69 designated Superfund cleanup sites. Michigan's industrial activities place it among the top five generators of hazardous waste in the U.S. We had the PCB issue. So do you see this being connected?
So we think so. We're wondering why, as you mentioned, Michigan has some of the highest prevalence rates in the United States, so it's highest in the Midwest. And Michigan has a very large number of Superfund sites, so these sites identified by the EPA as needing to be cleaned up. We rank higher than states like Texas in terms of the number of Superfund sites. I think I saw that California has 98. We have in the high 60s. And higher than the other surrounding states like Ohio, Illinois, Indiana. So we're polluted, unfortunately. We have the Great Lakes, which are wonderful, but they also are a reservoir, unfortunately, for some of these chemicals as they run off or as they've been put into the rivers and eventually the lakes, and they get trapped there. And because they break down so slowly, we believe we have these ongoing exposures. And the other factor is that we're looking at a large number of chemicals, and so we have to understand how do we relate them all together in a model.
And so does this research start pointing you down a road that could lead you to better, more effective treatments for ALS?
So I think it's going to lead us down the road to do two things. One is we hope treatments, but we also have an opportunity to identify a modifiable disease risk factor. And so for ALS, up until this point, we don't really have anything that I can tell my patients or their loved one or family members to say, if you don't do this, it's going to lessen your chance of getting ALS. It's not like the cigarette smoking, as we were referring to earlier, right? So if you stop smoking, your likelihood of getting lung cancer is going to decrease tremendously. So we don't have that. So that's number one. If we can identify really key toxins that drive not only susceptibility but progression in ALS, it's possible that we can target a modifiable disease risk. Now, the second item, what you referenced, is that if we can really understand mechanistically how these toxins act at the level of these brain cells, are there targets there that we can drug? So can we say that this enzyme or this metabolite seems to be increasing in response to this exposure, and can we interfere with that target and essentially come up with a new drug for ALS? And that's one of the other things we're focused on. We also need to understand, how do these toxins play a role with genetics, as I alluded to earlier? And are there particular genetic factors that maybe increase one's susceptibility to certain toxins? So we're interested in all three of these, and we're pursuing grants and other things to help us be able to study each of these three things.
Tell me if I'm wrong, but I believe I'm hearing you saying it's still too early to be able to say to people, if you do A, B, or C, you may minimize your chances of developing ALS, or are you at a point where you can say that?
So we have not proven causality. And so as a scientist, I think it's always important for me that we haven't proven causality. And so as excited as we are about seeing these findings, I can't say that this is a definite cause. And we have to understand that interplay between the genetics and between the environment to know what's, again, leading us up the cliff and then pushing us over the edge. However, I think we all understand that a lot of these toxins are probably not protective. They're probably not beneficial for you. And so ways of reducing your likelihood of perhaps ingesting or coming into contact with these toxins is a good idea. But I can't promise anyone at this point that if you do that, your likelihood of getting a disease is less.
So this is scientific research. It is like peeling an onion, mm-hmm. isn't it? You've peeled through a few layers. There are many more layers to go as you work through.
So I use that exact analogy with my patients. And so a lot of these things in neurology are like peeling back the layers of the onion. And the diseases are complex and coming up with solutions are complex. And we do need to peel back these different layers.
Well, more questions to be answered with research. The study has been published in the Journal of Neurology, Neurosurgery, and Psychiatry, as we've talked with primary author Dr. Stephen Gautman, who's director of the ALS Clinic at the University of Michigan. Thank you for sharing your work with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be able to speak on behalf of our great team doing this research.
Got any photos of Lake Michigan's sand dunes tucked away in the family photo albums or the shoebox of mom's old snapshots? Your old photos from that dunes outing in times gone by could help environmental researchers. The Michigan Environmental Council has put out a call for old photos of sand dunes. Tom Zimnicki is with the MEC. Tell us the idea behind this citizen science project.
Yeah, so the idea here is having citizens go out and collect photos as a way for us to better understand how dunes have changed over time. And so by going out and collecting old photos as well as repeat or recent photos, we're able to visually really be able to see those changes over time.
So exactly what are you looking for?
So we're looking for photos from up and down the coast as old as possible by being able to look at photos from, you know, the 1800s or early 1900s to today. We're able to see really striking differences in the landscape. And so looking for really any photos and preferably ones that really showcase the dunes and kind of a wide landscape facing the dunes.
And I suppose if grandma or mom had marked the location, that would even be a better bonus for you.
Yeah, and that's going to be a really important piece of this is understanding where exactly that photo was taken. That way we can go out with, along with our research team at Michigan State, and collect a new recent photo of that same place. And so being able to know that location to do repeat photography work, but also being able to then better understand how changes have happened in that specific location has been really key.
It strikes me when I think of photos from a same spot of a glacier over time.
Yes.
Pretty similar?
Yes, very similar. And so repeat photography work has been pretty prevalent out west, especially kind of in these desert landscapes as well as in some of those glacial settings, yes.
Now, what will you do with the pictures? Are you looking for them to be emailed? Can people put them, you know, find them and pop them in an envelope and mail them to you? And then what happens to them?
So there are a couple options. We have a whole webpage set up where people can go through and submit photos. And if they have a recent photo as well, they can submit them online through a form that we have on our website. There's also an email address that folks can send them to if that is easier. And if people have a box of hard copy photos and they just can't go through and scan them all, there's also contact information and we can arrange a way for us to get those photos from people.
Well, you might as well give us that page right now so people can find it.
Yeah, so you can find out more on our website, www.environmentalcouncil.org/sands of time.
It strikes me that if a family spent years coming to the same cottage along Lake Michigan or the same campground, there have to be photos through those decades that could really be rich source material for you.
Yeah, so we're hoping that folks that have cottage homes, especially like you said, I mean, that's likely they've been seeing that same place over and over. We're also hoping that organizations along the coast that maybe be focused on photography or art or some other community engagement, they might also be collecting photos just over the years. And so tapping into those institutions, those initiatives, and collecting their photos as well could be really valuable for us as well.
All right. Well, the call is out looking for any of your old photos of Lake Michigan's sand dunes. And apparently, very clear, the older, the better. Tom Zimnicki, Michigan Environmental Council, thank you so much for sharing this with us and good luck getting all those photos.
Thank you so much for the time. Have a good one.
And today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, Razi Joffrey, and Katie Raymond. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.